Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you've been on Facebook for any length of time, no doubt you've happened upon a post or two, or maybe many more, depending on your social media universe, about politics. And one politically minded post usually spawns many others, and not always in agreement, just because you're Facebook friends. Joining us now to talk about social networking and politics is Lee Rainey. Lee is the director of the nonpartisan Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project that studies the social impact of the Internet. Welcome to the show, Lee.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Question for our listeners. What do you do when someone posts something overtly political on your Facebook page? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Lee, the Pew Internet and American Life Project did a survey that looked at social networking sites and politics, and I wonder, does the frequency depend at all on the site? Like, in other words, Facebook versus Twitter, for example?
Probably it does. We did not look at that directly, mm-hmm. but Twitter is a bit more of a civically oriented, politically oriented space for lots of people. Facebook is somewhat more sort of social in general and more personal in general. So there might be differences in Twitter users compared to Facebook users. But the sort of broad thing that we were trying to understand in this survey was speaking to people's concerns that in the modern era of partisan politics, that people are living in echo chambers, that they only organize their social networks and they only organize their information flows to get information that matches their worldview and to hang out with people who believe the same things that they do. Well, it turns out that's not the case. And the way to think about this is, and for your listeners, is to think about their own conversational universes. Politics is probably a part of it, sometimes maybe even a small part of it, but it's not the whole thing. And so there is every likelihood that people have arranged their friendships and people interact with others without thinking much about politics, except on the rare occasions when it enters the conversation. And when it does, most people sort of ignore the political posts of others, particularly if they don't agree with them. It's not like they are reconstructing their social networks just to hang out with people like themselves.
Scott in Connell, Winchester, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
What do you do when someone posts political stuff on your Facebook page?
Usually just don't say anything because I don't have the energy to argue about it.
And in other words, it's often something you might not agree with.
Sometimes. I mean, I don't know.
Lee Rainey, that's because people don't get on Facebook to argue politics.
That's pretty much the story that we saw. If you just think about real life, you know, sitting around the dining room table or meeting with colleagues at work or hanging out at the mall, for some people, politics is a lot of what they talk about and care about and are energized about. But for most people, it's sort of an incidental thing in their life. And so it's often the case that people in social networking sites are truly surprised by the political views and political leanings of their friends. In this survey that we did, we found that two-thirds of Internet users, 66%, are on social networking sites. And then we asked them, did they do political things or did they see political things online? 38% said that they were genuinely surprised by their friends' views, that they hadn't anticipated that their friends had different views from their own and hadn't anticipated that their friends sort of thought differently about political and civic life. It's a really interesting aspect of research that people mistakenly believe that their friends think the exact same thing that they do. Why would they be my friend if they didn't have the same views that I did? But in fact, when politics enters the subject, there's genuine surprise going on, and it sort of speaks to this broader issue that I'm talking about, which is it's not the dominant part of people's conversations, and it's not the dominant part of the way that they organize their social networks, particularly in Facebook.
Talking with Lee Rainey, he's director of the Pew Internet Project, and we're talking about politics and social networking sites. Scott, just one more question. Have you ever been surprised by what somebody does post about themselves, or do you pretty much know what's out there?
I guess somewhat. I think that with politics, like, I think most people, I mean, I'm not saying that I research politics a lot, really know what I'm talking about, but I think a lot of people just don't know what they're talking about when it comes to politics, so I don't tend to pay
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. When you're talking about political views, Lee Rainey, what do we mean by that? Are we talking about people posting comments about gay marriage or the legalization of marijuana or some other kind of issue out there? Or are you thinking strictly in politics in terms of candidates and ballot issues?
We meant it to be a very broad definition of politics. So it's not just which candidates do you support or which party do you belong to, but also your views on community issues, on civic issues, on social issues like gay marriage, and on sort of national political issues and international issues as well. We meant to ask people about the very broad spectrum of stuff that most people would consider to be political chatter. And again, what we found was that it's not a dominant part of people's occupation, preoccupations on Facebook in particular, that they're catching up with their friends. They're talking about life in their neighborhood. They're talking about what's going on at work. They are commenting on other people's vacation photos and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so politics for some people matters a lot, and for other people it doesn't. And one of the most interesting things we saw was that the people who tended to be more often surprised than not were the people who had the strongest views. In other words, very liberal people and very conservative people were more likely to say, gosh, I'm surprised by so-and-so's post on this because I thought they were just like me, and it turns out they're not.
There was a post this morning before I went on the air from somebody on Facebook making sort of a joking reference to the fact that I bet you there are not many people, and they said what their occupation was, who vote for Barack Obama. And after that, it was just, 30, 40 comments right off the bat, and some of them from people saying, seriously, you voted for Barack Obama? And you could just tell. And is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. Politics and religion are kind of like third rail subjects for some people. It's just something to avoid if you don't want to get into arguments with people. And particularly during an election season, and particularly during this national moment when there's so much partisanship in the air, it's a subject that lots of people think is safe to avoid rather than engage in. But even innocent comments or not necessarily in your face argumentative comments, like I'm an Obama supporter or I'm a Romney supporter, if your friends observe that and don't necessarily think you're on the right side, they will let you know about it. And of course, one of the most dramatic places where you see the comments almost always deteriorate into name-calling and even worse is on media websites, news
right.
media websites, where they ask you to comment on stories, and particularly, there's a lot of political coverage, particularly in Ohio. And it only takes about one or two comments before people are talking about each other's mothers and stuff. And it's really sort of nasty. And so in some respects, this is a subject that lots of people don't want to engage in on Facebook because it just gets unpleasant.
Well, when it comes to the comment sections, the media comment sections, it seems like it's getting to the point where middle-of-the-road people don't even bother commenting. It's just one way or it's the far right or the far left duking it out. There's not a lot of plurality in the long run.
I think that's a great observation, and that's certainly kind of anecdotally what I see as well. And what happens then is that it probably gives the mistaken impression that that's all that people believe. In other words, if you've decided to remove yourself from that conversation, only watch it and not engage in it, you might think that you're the only one who doesn't believe the extreme views that seem to be articulated in these comment streams, when in fact, there's every likelihood you're in the majority. Most people don't feel that way. Most people don't get that worked up about politics, but they're not the ones who want to continue the argument and continue to try to mobilize their friends or continue to try to sort of beat down the other side and stuff. And so the tenor of the conversation in many instances gets more extreme and more vitriolic and more nasty over time. And that you're exactly right. That's what turns off a lot of people about political discourse in general, but also particularly in these spaces that are supposed to be social and friendly spaces. It's just sort of, why should I go in that direction when it just seems to bring woe to everybody who does?
Kind of gives new meaning to the silent majority. So how do social networking site users respond to political content? Is it like our caller, they just tend to just ignore it when it happens?
Yeah, that's generally the case, and particularly if the comment is coming from someone that they otherwise like or feel pretty close to. If they do react to it. They might sometimes block someone. If someone is too annoying and talks about it too much, or somebody's views are really antithetical to their own views, they will, about 18% of people have ended up shutting somebody out or blocking someone or unfriending someone on Facebook because of their political postings and stuff. So it's not a trivial number. You know, 82% of social network users haven't done anything like that, but 18% have. But about 16% of Facebook users have actually friended someone whose political posts they've observed and said, I like that. I like what that person has to say, or I like the articles that that person links to and stuff like that. So there's a little bit of activity in social networks where people are shunning people who are annoying or who don't have views like theirs, and they're embracing people who do have views like theirs, but it's not the majority experience. Most people just sort of take it as a matter of course and ignore it.
Some people don't want to be identified. If someone's posting on their Facebook page and other people can see it, other friends, they don't necessarily want to be identified with that person, and sometimes they'll shut them down, or at least they won't unfriend them, but they can delete their posts.
Yes, that's exactly right. There are times when people sort of say, I don't want to be associated with that point of view, and will either get rid of that comment or put that person on a slightly different status of alert and things like that. So there's definitely that kind of activity going on these sites. But the sort of broad suspicion and broad fear that people are isolating themselves in echo chambers and only dealing with others who feel like them, that isn't borne out in our data.
Right. At least not that they know.
At least not that they know. That's a good way to put it, because it might be that this is an off-the-table subject that just doesn't enter into friendship exchanges just because people don't want to get into the argument of it.
Well, Lee Rainey, thanks for joining us today and talking about that.
Thanks, Ann.
Lee Rainey, he's director of the Pew Internet Project. Coming up, we're going to talk about malware on our smartphones. It's here. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Cassandra Bonner spent a year on unemployment, and like millions of others, when a job offer finally came, she took it.
It's about half of what I was making before, but it's more than what I'd been making when I was unemployed, so we're fine.
I'm Neil Conan. The new economic reality for too many, the downwardly mobile. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation comes your way starting at 2 o'clock here at 89.7 NPR News. Talk of the Nation here Monday through Friday from 2 until 4. Right now we have 84 degrees at our studios here in the Fawcett Center on the OSU campus, going for a high of 89 with mostly sunny skies. Tonight, 65 for an overnight low. Lots of sunshine tomorrow, a little warmer too. We'll have a high of 90 degrees down to 89 by Thursday.
Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State Marion, presenting the Warren G. Harding Symposium, America at a Crossroads, the 1920 Presidential Campaign, July 20th and 21st. Tickets at 740-725-6340.
Perhaps it was inevitable, but smartphones are quickly becoming a popular target for malware, and although most people still don't recognize the dangers involved, joining us to talk about that and what you can do to protect yourself is Steve Fox, Editorial Director and Vice President for PC World. Welcome back, Steve.
Good to be back, Ann.
So, last week, researchers found malware that creates a botnet out of Android phones.
Yeah, this is dangerous stuff. Realistically, anytime there's a profit to be made from people do something a lot, in this case use their phones, well, the bad guys are going to find a way to do it. We're very used to the idea of, you know, malware and viruses on our PCs, but these things are absolutely spreading, and spreading fast, I should add, onto phones, especially smartphones, and especially to a lot of the Android phones. You know, Android is much more of a wild, wild west environment, and so because of it, this is where you're seeing a lot of these things show up. Now, the specific one that you mentioned, is... it was particularly frightening here because, you know, this showed up and people didn't realize exactly what it was.
How do you know? How do you know?
Well, I mean, there's a couple things. You know, one, a really good bit of malware, you actually don't know about it because it's doing something in the background and it will, you know, show up on your bill later. When you think about, for instance, Trojan horses, and Trojan horses are a common form of malware. They sneak into your operating system. There was, in fact, last week, and this is amazing, there was a Trojan horse called Find and Call that showed up not only in the Google Play App Store, so the Google App Store, but also in Apple's, you know, iOS App Store. And what this did, it, you know, sort of registered itself. It showed up piggybacking on something else. And it would ask you, you know, using social engineering, it would ask you to, you know, register your phone and email. And, you know, once it was inside, it could pretty much do what it wanted to. A very common thing for Trojan horses is they will try to use your SMS system, your messaging system, to send very expensive sort of premium messages to places, and then they can collect money from that. So, you know, that's kind of a classic way of doing this. In the case of the spam botnet, which was a pretty wild idea, you had this malware that was creating, essentially enlisting all of these phones, right, into this giant army that could send messages out. Now, we've seen this on PCs.
Right.
We've seen a lot of this, and people wouldn't know it, but their PCs were sending messages out over the internet, you know, advertising Viagra and whatnot. But now imagine that same sort of power applied to phones. And of course, it gets even more dangerous here in many ways because we pay for things sent out on our phones in various ways, right? You know, if it's a piece of spam that's sent, you know, it's not a good thing if your computer is taken over and is part of a botnet army. But you're not being charged at least on a per message basis, and you know that is something that can absolutely happen if you're sent by a phone. Now I want to mention Google denies that there was a botnet.
Right.
They say you know this their analysis says that it was a fake mobile signature, that it made it seem like these came from a botnet. You know, other researchers are. I've looked at the samples of the spam. By the way, the spam that comes from all over the place that's sent from this botnet. The list is Argentina, Ukraine, Pakistan, Russia. And I'll come back to Russia later because that's going to figure prominently in our malware story. But it does seem like all of these things were banded together and were sending messages. Now, one of the key things to realize here is that in general, the apps that do this, that are dangerous apps, they probably were not things that you're, in most cases, are going to download from the, you know, main stores, Google Play, you know, their app store, or certainly iOS, the app store there. But, you know, there are ways that you can download things from third parties, and they don't have the same sort of oversight on those applications, and some of them can be rogue applications that will do nasty things.
So how do you know? So you can't know if you're infected? Is there any kind of screen you can do to find out?
Well, yeah, sure, there is. I mean, I would say first off, if you're using an Android phone, as tempted as you may be to download apps that are not from the Google Store, don't do it. There's a thing you have to specifically check within your settings that says, you know, allow downloads from anywhere. I don't remember the exact language. I know because at one point I had it checked on my own phone, and then I read enough of these articles, got scared, and unchecked it. To go into your settings and just say, you know, essentially that you will not accept things that come from outside of the sanctioned channels. So that's one thing. The other thing is you can run a piece of software that's essentially, you know, antivirus. There's many of them, and many of them are free, and they work just fine. Now, just like with antivirus that you might have on your computer, that people do occasionally complain because they've seen some slowdown or whatnot. Mm-hmm. This is less severe, I would say, on phones. But given that this has now become a real problem, and for a long time it was a hypothetical problem, right? We always said, well, this is going to be a big deal at some point. Everyone's
right.
going to get on here. Well, that now is now. So it's probably a good idea to check out one of these antivirus programs and put it on your system, and that'll scan and tell you if there is some sort of a problem. So, you know, that's the first thing to do.
One of the security firms that did research on this said that malware threats are almost exclusive to Google's open mobile operating system, but a Trojan horse had been found in the new malicious in a new malicious app that had made its way to both Google Play and the Apple App Store. And that was shocking.
Yeah, that is shocking, especially anyone who's ever dealt with Apple on the App Store knows that they are very careful there as they screen applications. Now, once that app was found on both official sites, it was quickly knocked out.
But how did it get through?
Yeah, how did it get through? It means that it was a cleverly written application, that appeared to do something else. And the point is, when you're screening something, you know, you're looking for what is it asking for, what are its functions, and you know, a well-written Trojan can disguise itself and hide in the background. I mean, keep in mind, your Trojan is a malicious application. In a lot of these cases, it was created to send an SMS message to some sort of a premium rate number,
mm-hmm.
right? So you can get a Trojan in there. The program itself may seem to be doing something absolutely innocuous, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, if it's set to send out some sort of message, which then gets automatically billed, and they are able to siphon off some amount of that money, you can see how that is a real profit motive for the creator of that Trojan. I'll just give you some idea of some numbers, just some scary numbers here.
Okay.
So I was looking at a report from one of the vendors that looks at this market, and what they say is they've seen a 155% increase in mobile malware, and that was last year. But here's the crazy part of that: as you look at the percentage, and you talk about Android, they saw a 3,325% jump in malware for Android. And, you know, so that when you're looking at this, it's primarily because Android is an open system. Everyone can see into it.
No one's vetting it,
changes.
In other words.
Excuse me?
No one's vetting.
Right. Well, especially, yes. I mean, there is a feeling that, in fact, no one's in charge because it's open. Now, when it's on the official Google store, there is some oversight.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Google has announced that they are now doing Android market scanning, but still, a lot of people get Google apps from elsewhere because of the very nature of the beast. It's supposed to be open and free, and you want developers everywhere to be creating their own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get that, this is what happens. When you try to figure out what these apps do, a lot of these mobile applications can actually, I mean, good or bad ones, a lot of them can get the location of your device. And that's kind of handy information for a legitimate app. It's also pretty handy for an app that's not so legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
We saw something like nearly 15% of applications can make phone calls without the user's consent if you're looking at some of these, you know, nastier applications. So, you know, bits of malware. So, you know, these are on these secondary Android markets. and they're proliferating. I mean, it's really happening. It's really happening quickly. They're still using the number one method of attack, really, which is social engineering. The idea of I'm going to do something that will get you as the user to take some action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as opposed to they're going to come in and do all this behind your back. I mean, yes, there is some of that, but a lot of this is I'll send you some sort of message. Like fake installers, that's a big one, you know. And here we want to install this so that we can do this wonderful thing for you or you know, stop some sort of infection. And you have to actually take some sort of action to bypass any of the, you know, safety things that are built into the phone. you get about, of these, you know, 63% of them, according to this one survey I read recently, are some sort of a spyware. You know, they can capture your GPS coordinates, they can, check your text messages, your browser history, or something like that. So that's the biggest batch of these, fake mm-hmm. installer types. And then you've got those SMS Trojans that I was talking about, which can be used to send messages and that will cost you money.
Occasionally, a few times now, I've had my phone since January, I'm getting spam
mm-hmm.
on my phone.
Yeah.
What does that
yeah.
mean? Who's sending
okay.
that?
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, this is, it's different, but highly, highly related.
Okay.
So what's going on, and I've been getting a bunch of these as well, which really irritates me.
Yeah.
I often get offers, you know, you can try out the new iPhone right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, how did they get my phone number? And the way it works is you have a lot of ads that are now appearing, legitimate ads that appear on your phone, right? You know, I play Words with Friends.
It's, right.
You know, okay.
And you don't. You will not pay the 99 cents.
right.
Me too.
To get rid of those ads. So the ads come up. And, you know, I can't say that those ads are bad, but there mm-hmm. are a lot of ads and ad providers that use these sort of aggressive mobile ad delivery strategies. It's a small percentage that use these aggressive tactics, but they can do all kinds of things. They can change bookmark settings. They can deliver ads outside of the context of that ad. Of the app that you're using, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some of them can even, you know, get information. A lot of them can get information about you, your email, your phone number, or your name. Now, when you get the phone number piece, and as I said, it's not a large percentage, but some of them do this. Now these ads have your phone number. And what can they do? Well, they're ad networks. You know, ad networks do what ad networks do.
They sell.
So then suddenly, spam. You know, welcome to Spamville.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happens, I mean, it's a fine line here, you know, because I mean, clearly this is something that we don't want to see. Is that malware? I mean, maybe now we're into a question of a somewhat more semantic question. It's certainly something that's unwanted, something that you had not in any way that you thought signed up for mm-hmm. when you wanted to go play whatever that game was, but here it is. You're starting to get all of these messages, and you know these are a work of these very aggressive ad network, you know, sort of integrators. And I think we'll definitely see more than that. I mean, what will happen is, of course, regulations will come along, and then those regulations will be bypassed or you know ignored. People who write these kind of things are not, you know, necessarily going to follow the rules, and when they do get slapped down, they just try something else. And that's why very often in the malware world and antivirus world, it does feel a little bit like whack-a-mole, right? You,
mm-hmm.
you plug one hole and here comes another.
Well, you when I was looking at ideas for how to prevent this, or one of the tips was to watch the permissions. In other words, don't give out anything unless it's absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you are signing up for an app, you know, there's that screen that comes up that says, we'll be asking for this, that, this, and the other thing. And, you know, if it's an app, for instance, that has no need to know your location,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it says, we'll need to know, you know, click here to say it's okay to give your location, your mother's maiden name, your bank
yeah.
account, and, you know, whatever it is, you don't have to necessarily say yes on all of those. And sometimes you will not be able to use some of these applications because you're not willing to give the permissions. You know, I find that it's a little numbing to have to go through those screens. It's kind of like the EULAs, the end user license agreements. Everyone ultimately just clicks, okay, fine,
mm-hmm.
yes, be done with it. But in fact, on phones where you're downloading these applications, it certainly does pay to look at those and ask yourself the question, does does this application that tells me people's birthdays truly need to know my location and phone number, for instance? I mean, I'm making that one up, mm-hmm. but, you know, there would be a good example where we'd say, no, you know, it doesn't really need to know my location. So, you know, that would be worth looking at. What's kind of amazing about all of this, you know, we know we live in a global world. We've been saying this for a long time, and, you know, we are touched constantly by software and other things that are built elsewhere. But the stuff that's coming through right now is basically, you know, by and large, the nasty stuff coming through on phones, it's Russian and it's Chinese. Russian being the number one. I saw one stat that said 33% of the malware is of Russian origin that comes on phones. About 20% is Chinese. So, you know, if you're thinking about these, you know, whether it's click fraud, whether it's credit stealers, whether it's spyware, it's part of our new global economy. We are very close to the Russians and the Chinese. And so this is what you're going to see. So if you see some Cyrillic or some Chinese characters, you have a pretty, even more. Although, you know, they do a very good job of disguising this, and it, you know, it doesn't frankly matter where it comes from if it's going to harm you. But it is interesting as we look at the our ever expanding global economy. Part of that global economy means, you know, welcome aboard virus writers from everywhere. Equal opportunity victims.
So do your homework, check your sources, watch the permissions, use the anti-malware.
And probably, you know, let's not go wild downloading apps that are not from accredited sources. You know, unless you really have a good sense that this is safe. And it's a good idea. You know, maybe at least for now, it's good to stick to the tried and true, go to the app stores themselves. And I would say in general, you are going to be safer on the iOS platform for iPhone stuff, because Apple, for all the walled garden criticism that you know, they control everything. Part of course, controlling everything, and part of being a control freak, it does mean that less bad stuff can get through. On the other hand, there's wondrous stuff coming out on the Google Android side. It comes with a little more risk.
Google does have a new tool though to ID malicious apps. It's called Bouncer. So
yes,
they're working on it.
They do. I mean, part of what's overwhelming would overwhelm anyone. This is such a fast growing field on the Android side. And keep in mind, the other thing with Android, you know, iOS comes out with a relatively steady progression of upgrades, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Google, it's an explosion of creativity that happens on the Android side. So you're constantly getting, you know, a new Android operating system. And, you know, at any given time, you know, you'll have two or three or four different versions of Google Android that are you know, running on different phones. In fact, because it's open, you can do something called forking, which means people can essentially change Android for their own purposes. And we've certainly seen this a lot. You know, and that's allowed. They just have to publish it. It has to be, you know, open and accessible. But when you have this many variations on an operating system, as opposed to the sort of lockstep approach that you see with iOS, then yes, you're going to open up vulnerabilities, and people are going to spend a lot of time trying to find those vulnerabilities, all for the purpose of, you know, getting money from unwitting victims.
It's as old as time. Well, listen, Steve Fox, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, good. Thanks for having me.
Steve Fox, he's editorial director, vice president at PC World. Coming up, Russell Holley from Geek.com. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. On the next Fresh Air, will there be civil war in Afghanistan after the U.S. leaves? We talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Dexter Filkins about his article, After America, in The New Yorker. He covered the war in Iraq for The New York Times. He first reported from Afghanistan in 1998. Join us.
Terry Gross and Fresh Air coming your way in just about 20 minutes here at 89.7 NPR News. In the weather forecast for Central Ohio, quite pleasant. A high today of 89 degrees, low tonight 65. On Wednesday, mostly sunny skies and a high of 90. Then by Thursday, we'll get some clouds moving in, a high of 89. By Friday, showers and thunderstorms, 80 degrees for a high. Currently, we have 84 degrees at our studios here on the Ohio State University campus. Tonight on Frontline at 9 o'clock on WOSU-TV, Endgame, AIDS in Black America. It's an exploration of one of the country's most urgent and preventable health crises. The program traces the history of the epidemic through the experiences of individuals who tell their own stories. From pastors to health workers, people tell moving stories of the battle to contain the spread of the virus and the opportunity to turn the tide of the epidemic. Watch Endgame, AIDS in Black America, tonight on Frontline on our sister station, WOSU-TV. It begins at 9 o'clock this evening. Coming up next, the rest of Hope All Sides.
Wearable computers are changing the way we think about technology and computer access. Here to talk about this next advancement in personal computing, along with the latest updates on Google's Chrome browser and operating system, is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks for having me back.
Okay, so you got to try out a new wearable computer called the Epson Moverio BT-100, but they only let you use it for about an hour.
I got to mess with it for about an hour, and I had two of their design engineers who were kind of walking me through the stuff that they're doing. They're making a lot of changes to it right now. Mm-hmm. It is something that's available for purchase, but they're working on kind of the next version of it. So they were walking me through a lot of the changes they were making.
So, new stuff's coming out all the time. Sometimes things are obviously useful. Other times they seem excessive and purely luxurious. I know you like both. Where do you think the Epson glasses fall on that continuum? That they're actually glasses. Well, we haven't mentioned that. They look like glasses.
They're really big. I mean, you're obviously not going to be walking around town with these things on. They're pretty much space age goggles that you'd strap to your head. But they're not very heavy. So when you have them on your face, you're not putting like a lot of pressure on your nose or anything. But they are glasses, and they have a connector that snaps to the front that makes them shades as well for when you want, you know, kind of a better contrast view. But this is definitely a luxurious thing. This is something that, you know, unless there's a special medical case, you're getting this because you've got money to burn and you want to play with a new toy.
Mm-hmm. So what does it do? How does it work?
Well, so basically you put these glasses on, and there's a pair of projectors on either side of the parts of the glasses that, you know, connect to your ears, and they project onto small mirrors that reflect onto the actual visual space of the glasses. So where the glass would be on a normal pair of glasses, you'd still be able to see everything in front of you, but you would also have this kind of transparent image in front of you of a computer screen. In this case, you have a copy of what you would normally see when you look down at your cell phone.
So going forward, it's a luxury now. It's not particularly useful, but what do they envision it will be used for in the future?
This could very much replace how people interact with their existing computers. You know, instead of sitting down at your desktop to, you know, stare at a monitor on your screen or opening up a laptop on your couch or something like that, you put these glasses on and you know, stare at a bit of blank wall or something like that, and you'd get the same effect that you would, you know, from sitting down at your computer.
But you're moving your hands around in the air or what? How are you?
There's actually a pad that connects via a cable for this particular model.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've seen this before with Google's Project Glass, where they have a touch pad on the side of the lens that you go and you touch to you know, go through things. And we've got a lot of things moving forward right now when it comes to audio, you know, voice recognition technology. You know, both Apple and Google are making incredible strides there. So it's really not that far off to think that, you know, voice interaction is something that would happen with these devices very soon.
So they cost about $700 just for the glasses?
No, $700 gets you everything. It has everything preloaded in the pad that connects to it, and it's all contained in one box. And really, you can do everything from, you know, interact as though you were interacting with your computer. Because there are two projectors, they have a 3D mode. So if you're the kind of person who, you know, maybe you live alone or you just, you know, you really have like a personal viewing experience for when you watch movies or something, you can load a movie onto these glasses and watch them in 3D without the need for a really expensive 3D television or a 3D projector or anything like that. You really can just stare at a blank wall and have this 3D image come out at you, and you can watch the movie that way.
What's it like having it so close to your eyes like that?
You don't really perceive it as being close to your eyes. When you have it, the way that it projects onto the lenses, it feels as though instead of staring at a 3.5 or 4-inch screen, you know, that's right next to your face, you're actually staring at what is more closely related to a 60-inch screen, 10 feet away.
Do you wear glasses normally?
I do.
Yeah, so you can see okay without having your glasses on, or can you put these over your glasses, or how does that work?
You can put these over your glasses. I can also see pretty well without having my glasses on, and I tried both ways. It was a lot more comfortable to have them, with the glasses off, but it was still definitely usable in both cases.
Do you envision a future where these glasses become smaller and more mobile?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think that, you know, wearable technology is something that I think is really going to continue moving forward, especially with some of the stuff that Google is doing with Project Glass, which is very similar to what we're seeing from Epson here. And there was a patent filed a couple of years back that was just recently granted that gives Apple the ability to pursue wearable technology. So I really think that over the next couple of years, we're going to see some really exciting things in this particular field.
So if I have $700 to burn, do you recommend getting something like this? Is this a worthy expenditure yet or not yet?
I think that Epson has a lot of work to do in order to make this work, and there's a couple of things that it's missing in order for it to be truly functional. I don't think that this particular model would be something that I would buy, but I think that within the next year, we're going to see something that's definitely worth spending money on.
You mentioned last week that Google's web browser Chrome was coming to the iPhone and iPad, and now it's arrived. Why is this an exciting development for us?
This is a really exciting thing for anybody who uses a web browser, especially if you are, really not happy with how the browser works on the iPhone and the iPad. In my opinion, it's a really limiting experience.
Mm-hmm.
When you try to access websites, the websites don't always work the same way that they do on your computer, and it's really kind of a limiting experience. But Chrome actually takes that and makes, you know, especially on the iPad, but on the iPhone as well, it takes websites and renders them exactly the same way as they would if you were looking at a proper desktop or a laptop. You know, it works exactly the same way, and it takes a lot of the comfortable navigation that you get from, you know, pinching and zooming and scrolling with two fingers and things like that. It all works the same way in the Chrome browser as it does on your phone or your tablet. But it has one feature, in my opinion, that kind of makes it stand up above everything else. And that is that, you know, the Chrome on your iPad, Chrome on your desktop, if you use it on your desktop, Chrome on anything, they communicate with each other. So if I leave my office and I have tabs open on my desktop for, you know, an article that I was reading or a pair of shoes that I wanted to buy, I would be able to open up Chrome on my phone or on my tablet and be able to access those tabs exactly where I was on those web pages and just continue right where I left off.
It's like taking your computer with you then everywhere.
Exactly. It takes your entire browsing experience everywhere with you. And if you allow it, this is where, you know, kind of security comes into play. If you share your passwords with Chrome, which is something that you have the ability to do, then your passwords then are saved across all of your devices. So if you're the kind of person who doesn't remember passwords particularly well, and we've had this conversation
before. Oh, I don't even want to talk about it.
you can actually save them into Chrome, and if you go to access a website or something like that, because you saved it into Chrome for your desktop, your phone will have that password already saved.
All right, so They're saying some critics have said that Chrome runs slower than Safari, which is the server on the iPhone and iPad. So how much of a problem is that? Is it that much slower, or do you agree or disagree?
It's definitely not that much slower. And okay. the way that Apple designs their browsing experience, basically Chrome for the iPhone or for the iPad is basically an intelligent wrapper around Safari. It takes Safari and kind of amplifies it and does stuff. And because of that, you're going to get a little bit of natural slowing down, but you're also accessing a full website. You know, when you go to your website on or you go to Amazon or you go to, you know, even a couple of Google Pages or Apple's website on an iPhone, you get the mobile version of that website. You get, you know, everything is in a straight line with the menus all set up. It's designed to really, you know, make it easier to use on your phone. And unfortunately, that also cuts out a lot of content. Images take longer to load and things like that become really tedious. Chrome takes it and displays it as though you are looking at it from a computer, which takes, you know, a day or two to get used to. But what you get there is the entire website with no, you know, no need to you know, give and take because you're on a cell phone. You get the whole experience.
All right. So speaking of Chrome, Samsung has unveiled the new Chrome Box, which is a personal computer that runs a Chrome operating system. What is the Chrome Box?
So we've actually talked about Samsung Chromebook before.
Right.
And what it was, the laptop that ran Chrome. This is actually a desktop replacement. This is a small box. It's really small. I mean, it's something that is probably a third of the size of your keyboard if you were to look at it right now. It's really not very big at all. And you can stick it pretty much anywhere. It doesn't require a lot of power. It doesn't require a lot of space. And it runs the full Chrome operating system, which gives you access to the Chrome web browser that syncs, you know, back and forth like we were just talking about, and, you know, all of the apps that work with Chrome, which are really verbose now. There's really just a lot of different applications for Chrome OS that give it a very similar experience to if you're using Windows or the Mac. And they're really inexpensive. You know, they're right around $300 right now for one of these boxes.
So what is it? What's a Chrome OS like? How is it different?
Well, so this is where things get a little weird to explain. It's just the browser.
Right.
But when you think about it, you know, a lot of people do everything in the browser right now. We do our Facebook, we do email, we do everything. It just takes the browser and it takes the file management system for when you need to print something or when you need to download something, and just presents it all, in a very convenient format. You know, it just takes it and makes it very, very simple. It removes the need for applications to update. It removes the need for antivirus software. It removes so many of the weird things that we have to go through when we own computers, just to get online to do something.
It mentions in an article I read that it makes it strong security, manageability, few moving parts, which should allow schools to get plenty of use out of the hardware.
Yeah, Google actually has a special deal for schools where they can purchase them at bulk, and instead of buying them all at once, they can pay like a monthly rate for them. And as a really cool add-on to that, if one of them breaks, they get replaced just as part of their contract with Google. They don't have to pay for a new box.
So you sound very positive about it. You'd recommend it?
Who would you recommend it for?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where it comes down to. I would recommend it for somebody who can identify that they are already doing everything on the web. You know, for somebody, obviously for somebody who's manipulating photos professionally or, you know, playing with videos or is really, really into computer video games, you know, or things like that, then, you know, Chrome OS really isn't designed for that kind of use. But if you're the kind of person who already, the first thing you do when you sit down to a computer and the last thing you do when you leave is open up a web browser, then Chrome OS is probably all you need.
And we already said it's around 300. I saw 330, but where can people get it?
Right now, they're all available online. They're available through Amazon and a couple other stores. And I think starting at the end of the summer, we're going to start seeing them in Best Buy stores.
Now, how did the Chromebook do?
I was personally a fan of the Chromebook for somebody who just wanted a machine that, you know, had an all-day battery that they could take and run around and do things with. But in terms of sales, they couldn't get the price down low enough, and they couldn't get it in stores for people to put their hands on to really understand. And mm-hmm. as we've discovered in this conversation here, when you try to explain to somebody without being able to hand it to them, you know, what Chrome OS is and does, it loses a bit in translation. So they didn't sell very well to begin with.
Well, that seems to be the case with a lot of stuff now that you need to get, you know, you just get it online. It makes you wonder about a lot. It makes you wonder about the advantage that Apple has with their stores in the malls.
It's definitely a powerful thing to have somebody be able to walk in and put your hand on something and to have a knowledgeable person standing there to be able to answer any of the questions that they have. We're definitely in an ecosystem where there's a strong desire to purchase things online. But when you breach that, I'm going to go ahead and say $100, $150 price point, people want to put their hands on it first.
Right. What else? Anything else you want to talk about before we go, Russell?
There's a lot of devices that are updating to Android 4.0 this week.
Okay.
If you have the Motorola Droid Razr or Droid Razr Max, or if you have the Samsung Galaxy Note, you're probably going to get an update either today or tomorrow that's going to give you instructions on how to get the latest version of Android on your phone.
And you want it.
You definitely want it. It's going to give you some battery life improvement. It's going to make things a lot smoother. And in the case of the Samsung Galaxy Note, Samsung included a lot of really neat features that work with the stylus. They give you some additional stuff. You know, you can there's the shape detector for when you draw certain things, and it makes things a little easier to use overall. So it's definitely worth it.
See, a question I wanted to ask about the glasses, real quick, the wearable computers. What about those kinds of things like typing? You do it all from it. No, typing's the wrong word, but when you want to create a document and you want to write in it, you do it all from that little pad.
Right now, you do it all from that little pad. That little pad also has Bluetooth connectivity, so if you wanted to use a Bluetooth keyboard, you'd be able to do that.
Okay.
And a lot of this stuff, it is running a version of Android, so it does have speech recognition software.
Right.
And the speech recognition software for Google is really good, so you can, you know, if you want to be that guy who sits in a quiet room and talks to himself for a while, you can, you know, write a document that way.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, do you think that's where we're headed?
I don't know that we're headed in a direction where people are going to want to talk to write things that are more than a sentence or two long.
Right.
And that may just be me personally.
Well, it's me too.
Anytime I go to send a message to somebody that's longer than, say, you know, okay, I'll be there in a couple of minutes, mm-hmm. I usually don't talk that into my phone. I usually just type it. And I think that's probably pretty common. So I don't think the keyboard's going anywhere anytime soon.
Okay. Well, Russell Holly, as usual, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holly from Geek.com. You can listen back to today's shows and every show by visiting WOSU.org/allsides. Explore the All Sides archive where you can find more information, links, and audio and video of every show. Also, be sure to like All Sides with Ann Fisher on Facebook and follow me, Ann, on Twitter, at Ann Fisher WOSU. I want to thank the staff today. Associate producer Amy Jurevich, All Sides intern Corinne Gleckler, All Sides volunteers Rachel Ramey and Andrew Sweet, with video production by Rich and Amber Karsmiski. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks so much for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses since 1855. More information at 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.